You drop your phone, pick it up. Okay. I don't know why there's a screen in front of me. Probably going to trip and fall. But we're going to start the class with our usual start of the class test. Okay? So you ready? Here's the first question. You are valuing a Swiss company. You can give the Swiss company a name. A Swiss multinational. Let's call it Nestle. Okay? It gets 10% of its revenues in Switzerland, 30% of the EU, 40% of the US, 20% of its revenues in India. I've given you the risk-free rates in all four currencies. What risk-free rate will you use in the valuation? I'm going to give you some choices. There's obviously one right answer and lots of wrong answers. So don't blurt out the answer till I give you all the choices. You could take a simple average of those risk-free rates. You could take a weighted average of those risk-free rates. Maybe you should use the Swiss franc rate because it is the lowest. No, it's a Swiss company. Maybe you should use the lowest of the rates, whatever that turns out to be. Maybe you should be conservative and use the highest of the rates. Maybe the answer is none of the above. First, what do you think about averaging? You know the problem with averaging risk-free rates is? If I told you the average temperature between New York, remember we played that game of Fahrenheit and Celsius? I said the temperature in New York right now is 47 degrees and Frankfurt it's 10 degrees. The average temperature in the two cities, let's add the two numbers and divide by two, would be completely meaningless, right? You cannot ever use weighted average or average risk-free rates because you get mishmash. You're not even sure what currency it is. So that's off the table. Should I use the Swiss franc rate because it's a Swiss company? Not necessarily. What was the rule we said for currencies? Pick a currency and then be consistent. If you want to value Nestle in Swiss francs, your risk-free rate will be a Swiss franc risk-free rate. If you want to value Nestle in British pounds, your risk-free rate will be a British pound risk-free rate. If you want to value it in US dollars, it will be a US dollar risk-free rate. Make your choice and then be consistent, because then you've got to convert all your growth rates in these different regions into a dollar. So that's the challenge you face in multinationals. It's don't mess with the risk-free rate. I want to make sure everybody's clear on that, because I see a lot of valuations that, not from my classes, but that are out there, where people talk about a global risk-free rate. There is no such thing. There is no global risk-free rate because there is no global currency. There is a specific currency, and the risk-free rate goes to the currency. It doesn't go with the country or with the geography. Is everybody comfortable with that, right? Second, yesterday we talked about, Wednesday we talked about historical risk premiums. And we talked about how to estimate it. We look backwards and we come up with what we'd have made investing in stocks and what you'd have made investing in T-bonds or T-bills. And I said that difference is a historical premium. We talked about all the limitations of that approach, but let's say you decide to compute a historical risk premium. I'm going to give you some choices on what you're going to use to come up with that risk premium. You could go with this rule of, I want something very current and used just last year. In which case, what's your equity risk premium going to be for... What did stocks do last year? First, did they do well or badly? Let's see whether you've actually been given. They did really well. There was a 31% return on the S&P 500 last year, 31%. T-bonds had a 9% return. That difference would be 22%. You're saying, this is good, I'll use that as my equity risk premium for the future. Do you see the danger you're exposing yourself to? You can't take a really good year or a really bad year and extrapolate it. So just 1 year, you're probably asking, how about 5 years? That should give you some averaging, right? Maybe I should go back as long a time period as I can get historical data for. In the US, I can go back to 1928 with my data. In fact, Robert Shiller, who teaches at Yale, has data going back to 1871. Maybe I should try to be consistent. If I'm using a 10-year T-bond rate, which is what I said you should use, maybe I should go back only 10 years. Or maybe if I'm going to estimate betas using a 2 or 5 years, I should go back 2 or 5 years. Okay, lots of choices. 1 year, 5 years, Go back as far as you can, match up. Which one should you pick? Do you remember what we talked about with those? Each of those historical risk premiums, what did we talk about was the statistical issue you faced? Do you remember? There's noise in that estimate, right? Standard error. If you use 5 years of data or 10 years of data, I said you get noise. Basically, the noise will drown out your estimate. It's not enough data. If you're going to use a historical risk premium, I know you won't like this. You have to go back as far as you can, but you're saying 1928 was very different. You're right. If you want to go with history, you've got to get a long history, and that long history is going to take you back to a point where the market looks nothing like the market today. That's a price you're going to pay for using historical risk premiums. And if you use historical risk premiums, let's look at the mechanics of what will happen to it if next year is a terrible year for stocks. Let's say it's like 2008. Remember in 2008, stocks were down 25% in 1 year. So let's say it's a crisis year. At the end of the year, you've added one more data point to your analysis, right? If I compute the historical risk premium, then including that really bad year, will my risk premium go down or go up after a really bad year? It'll go down mathematically, adding a really bad year. You're saying, so what? What happens in a really bad year? You're in a crisis. In a crisis, you're getting more scared. And when you get scared, remember we said the risk premium is what you demand for taking on risk. Would you demand a bigger risk premium or a smaller risk premium after a crisis? I would demand a bigger one, and if you use historical risk premiums, you're actually getting the opposite answer. So today, I'm going to come up with a different way of thinking about risk premiums. But before I hit you with the convoluted mechanics, I'm going to set up the process with a very simple exercise, and somebody here has to help. Let's assume, so you're going to be my guinea pig. I'm sorry, sit in the front. You're going to be my guinea pig. I come to you and offer you an investment where you're going to make a dollar a year, every year, forever, with certainty. How much would you pay for that investment? Okay, good. Tell me what do you think the risk-free rate is right now? Maybe 2%? Let's make it nice round numbers. Let's make it 2%, right? So right now, that will give you about $50. Do you see why that would work? Because if you take $50 and you earn a dollar every year, that's roughly 2% a year making risk-free rate. So $50. Now, I'm going to make the problem a little trickier. I'm going to offer you a dollar every year, but not guaranteed. It's going to have roughly the same amount of risk as the average stock. Remember, you offered me $50 before for the investment. Would you offer me less or more for this new investment I've given you? You're getting the same dollar, but now it's an uncertain dollar rather than a guaranteed dollar. You can all join in. Now you don't have to just watch him. Think about it. You'd pay less, right? Give me a number.
35,
okay. When he says he's willing to pay 35, has he told me what his risk premium for stocks is? What's the return that's going to work out to? Roughly 3.3%, maybe 3.2%. The risk-free rate is 2%. You've told me what your risk premium is. Do you see where I'm going? If you tell me what you're willing to pay for a risky investment, you don't have to tell me what the risk premium is. What you pay matters more than what you say. I can go and say, what's your risk premium? What's your risk premium? You can make up numbers. But then if I ask you to pay, I'm going to see really how much you're demanding. And that is exactly the opening I'm going to use to compute what's called an implied premium. Do you see how I'm going to do it? I'm going to say, look, how much are people willing to pay for the S&P 500? I can observe it right there at the end. What are the cash flows? A little messier than the dollar example that I did. But if I can do that, then I can tell you, based on what the index is priced at, what the equity risk premium is, because that's what people are paying. So we have a lot on our plate today. Let's get the process rolling by going back to where we were in the slides. I noticed some typos in the slides. I was sloppy. I fixed all the typos on my version of the notes, but unfortunately I can't do it. So I'll send you the pages on which I made the fix. Most of them are very minor. You probably didn't even notice them. Most of them are forgetting to replace 2019 with 2020. The numbers are all 2020 numbers. But there was one page in particular. I read the page and said, what? I must have been, I'm in San Diego. There's a lot of people smoking weed around. Maybe I took my dog for a walk and I came back and I was completely high. I don't know. No. And I read the patient, what am I even asking? And if I don't know what I'm asking, I can't ask you to answer something that I don't know. So I had to fix that page because clearly I was something. So let's pick up where we left off. If you remember, I computed the historical risk premium for the U.S. market going back to 1928. Then I showed you all those numbers. And roughly speaking, the historical risk premium is about 4.83%. If I go all the way back to 1928, but then I added a caveat, which is there's this big standard error of 2.2%, don't trust me. And then I ended with this, hey, when you look at historical premiums, not only do you have that noise, the standard error, you also in the U.S. have a problem of a selection bias, which is you pick the most successful equity market in the 20th century, and you're using that as a basis for predicting what I will do in the next century. And this problem gets worse as you go, the problem of noise gets worse as you go outside the U.S., why? Because the U.S. has the richest and longest history of stock market data of any market in the world. So you go to Europe, the Second World War breaks the markets in most European markets. You actually have a shutdown of trading. The U.S. markets traded all the way through the Second World War, but the Austrian market stopped in 1940 for a few years, and you, who can blame them? All of Europe, markets were not front and center in what people wanted operating. So you don't have as much historical data outside the U.S., even if you go to European markets, and it gets much worse if you go to Asian or Latin American markets. There, the history often runs out after 20, 25, 30 years, at least reliable history. You can get the Sensex, the Indian index going back to 1950, but it really is not a representative, because until the late 60s, maybe into the 70s, the liquidity in the market was so light, you really weren't getting a proxy for the overall market. Do you see where I'm going? If you need a lot of data to estimate a historical risk premium, you're already out of the game if you're looking at the Brazilian market, the Chinese market, the Vietnamese market, the German market. So I want to talk about how to estimate equity risk premiums for these markets. Here's one thing you could try. Let's say you become an analyst, and you're valuing a Brazilian company. The company comes and says, what are we worth? You say, look, you know, I don't have enough historical data to compute your risk premium. Come back in about 60 to 70 years. This is usually not great consulting technique because you lose the client. So we need to estimate something right now, right? So let's start with a very simple process. Let's say that you can estimate the risk premium for the U.S., you feel okay, 4.83%, or I'll give you an alternative, 5.2%. You'll see in a minute where the 5.2% comes from. That's the premium you're demanding for investing in a company that makes all of its revenues in the U.S. You ready? I come to you with a company that makes all of its revenues in Brazil. Would you expect the premium to be higher than 5.2% or lower than 5.2%? Higher. Why? It's a riskier market. So this becomes our challenge. How much should we add to the 5.2% to come up with a risk premium for Brazil? So we're looking for some number on country risk, right? And I've actually given you one way to get that number. If you remember, when we came up with risk-free rates and reais and rupees, what do? We start with the government bond rate, and then we looked up the default spread for the country. You might have issues with default spread, but it's a number that is out there. So in the case of Brazil, that number, if you remember, based on its rating, was 2.51%. If you went with the CDS, it was 1.7. So basically, depending on, but I have a number for Brazil, 2.51%. I'm almost home. In the first way of getting risk premiums, this is the way investment banks actually do it. This is a default approach. You start with a base premium for the U.S., and often it's made up in investment banks, but no, we'll use historical or implied. Let's say it's 5.2%. And to that, you add the default spread of 2.51%. And with this approach, my risk premium for Brazil will be 7.71%. Is everybody clear on what we're doing? We're taking the U.S. premium, we're adding the default spread. As I said, this is the state of the art, if you can call it that, of estimating country risk premiums, U.S. premium plus a default spread. I've always had an issue with this approach, and we'll come back to it in a minute. And here's what it is. I said a minute, a second, I've come back to it. No. This is the default spread. 2.51% is the spread I'm charging for buying what? A Brazilian government bond, right? But here, what am I buying? I'm not buying Brazilian government bonds. I'm buying Brazilian equities, which are a much riskier class. So here's the second approach for estimating a country risk premium. You start with the U.S. premium, just like I did, the 5.2%, and you look up two numbers. The first is the standard deviation in the Bovespa. The Bovespa is the Brazilian equity index. Let's say it's 30%, the standard deviation. And the second is the standard deviation in the S&P 500, which is 18%. Remember algebra? You should, right? If I have a market with a standard deviation of 18% where I'm demanding 5.2%, what if I came to you with a market with a standard deviation of 30%? All I'm going to do is take the 5.2% and scale it up to reflect the fact that Brazil is a riskier market. I come up with a risk premium for Brazil of 8.67%, 5.2% scaled up by the fact that Brazilian equities are riskier. This is the Goldman Sachs approach to doing equity risk premiums. And if I use this approach, I'm attaching a 3.47% additional premium for Brazil. It looks good, right? But here's the problem with this approach. If I use this approach, the equity risk premium for Pakistan is actually less than the equity risk premium for the U.S. And here's why. The standard deviation of the Pakistani equity market is far lower than the standard deviation in the U.S. equity market. I say the same thing. Costa Rica looks really, really safe. Ivory Coast has no risk at all. You know why, right? What are standard deviations based on? Traded prices. So what's happening in these markets that's making? If you have no trading, prices can't move. If I take entirely all of the market, it looks safe. It's actually not safe at all. But if all I have is observed prices, the standard deviations of equity markets with very low liquidity are going to drop off, not because they're safe, but because there isn't enough trading. So the second approach, and now if you go to my website, I've calculated for countries, the problem you're going to run into is any low standard deviation market is going to look like it's safe, and you're going to end up attaching too low a premium. So I'm going to give you my third approach. This is the approach I use, and I've kind of led up to it because I don't like the first approach because default spreads are for bonds. I don't like the second approach because I'm comparing a very liquid market in the U.S. to markets that are not liquid. In the third approach, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take two markets in the same country. Instead of going outside the country, in the case of Brazil, I'm going to take the Bovespa, which is the equity index, and I'm going to come up with the standard deviation of 30%, just like I did before. But now, instead of looking up the standard deviation for the S&P 500, I'm going to look up the standard deviation of that Brazilian government bond. Remember the one I got the 2.51% default spread on? That bond, let's say, has a standard deviation of 20%. So what am I doing? I'm charging a 2.51% default spread for a bond with a standard deviation of 20%. You're telling me equities are 1.5 times more risky. I'm going to take the 2.51% and scale it up for that additional risk. I come up with an equity risk premium for Brazil of 3.77%. Add it to the 5.2%, I end up with a risk premium of 8.97%. Now, you're saying, which one is approach? I can't prove to you my approach is right. I feel more comfortable with it. But if you feel more comfortable with the second approach, or you feel the first, I am completely, this is not going to make or break your valuation. But be consistent. You can't pick and choose and move across the approaches. But the first approach, because it's default spread based, I think it's too narrow. The second approach, because it compares standard deviations across markets with very different liquidity, is flawed for that reason. The third approach, at least I have a shot of getting the right number. So the start of every year, I compute this number on my website. There's a lot of data on my website if you visited the data. This is the most downloaded data set on my website by far, the risk premiums I compute for countries. You know the old saying about sausages? That if you want to eat sausages, what's the one thing you never want to do? See how they're made. I'm going to take you inside the sausage factory. Because there are people who use these risk premiums in the strangest places. They have no idea. They think I do go through this sophisticated. They think I have a team. In fact, I get emails saying, could you tell your team to look at this number? And I say, I'll talk to my team. And I talk to myself and say, no, I couldn't get it. My team is not cooperating. I can't get back to you. Right? So you're going to see the sausage being made. So this happens in the first week of the year. So if you've seen Hamilton and you want to see how the risk, you come into the room. This is the room where it's computed. So you're inside the room. First step in the process is I compute an equity risk premium for the S&P 500. I've been showing you how I do this, but I'll show, take you through the process. At the start of 2020, the equity risk premium for the S&P 500 was 5.2%. I've got my base. Second step, I take every country which has a rating on Moody's or S&P. Moody and S&P rate countries. It's called a sovereign rating. I look up the local currency rating. Moody's rated 135 countries last year. S&P rated 120. Combined, I got a rating for 141 countries. I have a rating. See where I'm going to go next? With Brazil, when I had a rating, what did I went to the lookup table. I looked up the default spread that went with the rating. So I looked up the default spread for each of these countries. Then I considered doing what I did for Brazil, which is look up the standard deviation in the equity index and the standard deviation in the government bond. But here's the problem I ran into. Only about 30 or 35 of these countries have government bonds. I can't even look up that number. So I cheated. So here's what I did. I looked up the standard deviation in two indices. The first is an S&P Emerging Market Equity Index, so basically across all emerging markets. And the second is an S&P Government Bond Index of emerging market government bonds. That ratio at the start of 2020 was 1.18. So let's pause here. My equity risk premium for the U.S. is 5.2%. Let's say that based on your rating, your default spread should be 2%. I'm going to take the 2% and multiply it by 1.18. That gives me 2.36%. Add the 2.36% to 5.2%. I've got your equity risk premium as a country. And I go through all 140 countries. So this is what the world looked like to me at the start of 2020. So basically, I've geographically broken down countries. I sometimes screw up on this, and I never hear the end of it. Now, once in a while, I put an African country in the middle of Latin America, and I, you know, or I put Greece in an emerging. You know. So let's not go. So basically, I think I've got every country in the right place. Let's take Asia. Right? So the list of countries. You're saying, what are the red numbers are the default spread scaled up by 1.18%. So if you take, for instance, India has a country risk premium of 1.88%. Its default spread is like 1.59. You multiply by 1.18, you got 1.88. You're saying, what's the 5.2? 5.2% is the risk premium for the U.S., and you're going to see a lot of countries on that list who have exactly the same risk premium as the U.S. I'll list out the countries, and you tell me what they share in common. Canada, Australia, Germany, Netherlands. What do they have in common, you think? We can tell if there's any country have a reliable government. That would put me in a place where I don't want to go, right? What did I say I used to measure country risk? I went to Moody's and I looked up your rating. So what do you think? They're all AAA rated countries. I know this is incredibly sloppy, but I have far bigger fish to fry than sitting there doing country analysis for the rest of the year. So if you're a AAA rated country, I call you a mature market and I give you the same risk premium as the US, and here's my rationale. If you have five mature markets, you can't have different risk premiums across them. Why not? If money can move from market to market, let's say I told you the equity risk premium for Germany is only 3%, the US is 5.2%. Remember, money can move across. Those markets have no barriers to capital. Money is going to leave Germany and come into the US. So 5.2% becomes a premium for all AAA rated countries. If you're not AAA rated, the red number captures the additional country risk premium. Add it to the 5.2%, I get a risk premium, an equity risk premium for your country. So if you look across Asia, the most risky countries are Mongolia, Pakistan, Solomon Islands. Is that even in Asia? I guess it's in the Pacific, somewhere off Asia. And within Asia, the safest country is? What's the only AAA-rated Asian country? Singapore. Okay. Singapore has a 5.2% risk premium. I told you this was the most downloaded data set on my website. It gets used, as I said, also in the strangest places. I've lost control of it. And I get emails sometimes from people using it with the strangest requests. You get an email from the New Zealand Milk Board. I didn't even know there was a milk board in New Zealand until I get the email. So we're using your country risk premiums to set milk prices for New Zealand farmers. were they selling the milk to? Zimbabwe? What is this country that's coming in? But there, at least, they said, well, we want to know how you come up with the risk premiums. And I just took you through the process. Now, I said, look, it's not rocket science. I don't do some deep research. There's no team involved. I take the rating. I do. But once in a while, I do get an email I'm not sure how to respond to. April of 2009, I get an email from Lebanon. I don't get that many emails about valuation from the Middle East. So I open it up. And here's how it begins. You have destroyed Lebanon. I said, what? After 25 years of civil war in Hezbollah, I'm the guy who destroyed Lebanon? What did I do? Eh? And it turned out that the email was from a Lebanese business person whose business had been appraised for value, and the appraiser had used the risk premium for Lebanon off my website. Yeah, there's Lebanon right now. 14. That number was 17.5% because, you know, risk premiums are higher. Lebanon was a risky country. You see why this guy was pissed off? You put a 17.5% risk premium in your discount rate goes through the roof, your value goes through the floor. He was convinced he'd been gypped. It was all my fault. My first reaction was, take it up with your appraiser. It's not my problem. But then I did remember the email was from Lebanon. And I decided I had to be a little diplomatic about the way I answered it. I said, it's not my fault. You see whose fault it is? Where do I start your assessment of country risk? I go to Moody's and I look up your rating. So if your rating is in the toilet, guess what? You're going in there with it. I said, you know what? It's not my fault. It's Moody's fault. If you want an address to enter into your GPS, you might want to consider the Moody's address. What, 77 Church Street, New York, New York? Don't do 44 West 4th Street. I have nothing to do with it. There is no intellectual firepower behind these numbers. But what they have going for them is, I think, they're transparent. You can see where they come from. You're saying, what are these countries at the top? These are called frontier markets. What are frontier markets? These countries have no rating. Why do they not have a rating? Well, let me list out some of the countries, and you can see very quickly why. There's Syria, there's Sudan, there's North Korea. Can you imagine being the Moody's analyst? Your boss calls you and says, I'd like you to go to North Korea and come back with a rating. You go to North Korea, you'll probably never come back. So these are frontier markets, and for a long time, I didn't compute country risk premiums for them, and my defense was, hey, they're not rated, I can't compute it. So about 3 years ago, I get an email from Syria. From a Syrian business person, must be the last guy left in Syria still running a business. He says, I run a business, I need hurdle rates for my business, to which my point is, get your perspective here, you don't want hurdle rates, this is your top, you know. And I'm looking for an equity risk premium for Syria on your website, and I cannot find it. Why? Very aggressive why. And I explained to him. I said, look, Syria doesn't have a rating. I can't give a... And then he emails me back 15 minutes. So what do you want me to do? I could have told him what I wanted him to do, but I didn't think he would take it well. So, and I said, okay, you have a point. I'll give you a risk premium. So starting about 3 years ago, I decided I have to assess this. If you're a company that gets half your revenues from North Korea and half from Syria, you need a risk premium too. Why should I? So here's what I did. There's a service in Europe called Political Risk Services. It gives a numerical country risk score for countries, including countries like Sudan, Syria, North Korea. So I went to their website, looked up the risk score for Syria, 38. So the risk scores go from low to high. Low are really risky countries, high are very safe. So Switzerland is 92, safest country. Syria was close to the end. I found four other countries with risk scores between 35 and 40. So go along with me, guess what I did? Two of those four countries had ratings and a risk premium. I took the average and attached to those two countries and gave it to Syria. You're saying, that is so unsophisticated. Guilty as charged, but if you can come up with a better way of assessing Syrian country risk, I'm willing to listen. But I've got the world covered here. And here you're saying, how many Syrian companies am I going to value? Hopefully not very many. But you don't need to have a Syrian company to value it, right? So, in fact, there's a question I jumped over. What was your question?
Yeah, I have actually a question about why did you put some of the EU countries within the Israel and Russia?
Because going in the EU doesn't make risk. So basically, I put you in the region, but I gave you a risk premium that's appropriate. So you take the Czech Republic, right? Czech Republic, I put it in there. But I gave you a risk premium that's low. Why? Because you could be, so geographically, you're in the east, in Eastern Europe. You can't take that away. You are not a risky country like you might have been 10, 20 years ago. So don't focus on geographic, because I'm not contaminating you by putting in a risky region, because I still assess your risk based on your rating. Because ultimately, you could actually argue that Western Europe has become a much more diverse place in terms of risk. You know, the equity risk premium for Northern Europe is close to 5.2%. Netherlands, Germany, they're all Sweden, they're all AAA rated. You come to Southern Europe, you have Italy, Spain, Portugal. You know the equity risk premium for Southern Europe is? It's higher than the equity risk premium for Asia now. Because you've got this additional risk. So geography is only part of the game. I put it in there because geographically, it is Eastern Europe, right? The EU is, I mean, you could have the EU kind of keep stretching out, Kazakhstan. But ultimately, I'm still going to assess your risk based on your rating. And if you're a safe country in Eastern Europe, I still give you a lower risk premium. Any other questions on the country risk? Okay. So let's talk about how we go from this assessment of country risk to a company's exposure to country risk. Here are the three choices you face. One is you take a risk-free rate, you add the country risk premium as a constant to the company, and then you take beta times traditional equity risk premium. So basically, country risk premium is a fixed number. The second, you bring the country risk premium into the brackets and multiply by beta. The difference between approach one and two is if you're a high beta company, with approach two, you'll have a much higher cost of equity because if you're a high beta company, I'm saying you're more exposed to country risk just like every other risk. Which is right, you know, that's a judgment call. I use method the second approach. But if you use the first approach again, I'm not going to push back that much because it's not a theoretical argument. It's a pragmatic argument. And there's a third approach which says, for some reason, you go from Microsoft Mac to Microsoft PC, it does weird things like change my betas to question marks. Later, you'll see things turn to bicycles. Don't ask me, something turns to bicycles. So whenever you see the question mark, it's a beta, right? So question marks are beta, so fix it again. Plus a lambda. So basically what I've done is I've separated the two risks and said, the exposure you have as a company can be different to the two. So let's take that structure and ask the question of how should we assess country risk? You know how most analysts assess country risk? They look at the country in which you're incorporated and say, you're an Indian company, you're exposed to Indian country risk. You're a Chinese company exposed to Chinese country risk. You're an Indonesian company exposed. You're saying, what's wrong with that? Let's take two Indian companies, Tata Consulting Services and Tata Motors. In fact, Tata Steel. They're both Indian companies. But Tata Consulting Services gets 93% of its revenues outside India. You know from where? US and Western Europe. So the argument I've always made against this, because this is a default practice. You see it in investment banks. Tell me where your company is located. I'll give you that country risk premium. Said, your risk should not come from where you're incorporated. It should come from where you do business. You're a German company with 100% of your revenues in Afghanistan. Don't tell me you're headquartered in Berlin. I really couldn't care less. Your risk comes from where you do business. To me, it seems intuitive, but it's amazing how tough a sales pitch this is to many analysts because they're still caught up in where you incorporated, where's your risk come from? So let's see how this would play out. Let me take two examples of companies. The first is Embraer in 2004, and I'm going to use this kind of illustrate how extreme a company's exposure could be. You're familiar with Embraer? If you've ever taken a short flight in the U.S., you know that brochure they put in the little thing that we never read? Pick it up. Because half the planes you're on are Embraers, the other half are Bombardiers. Okay? Bombardier is a Canadian company. Embraer makes small passenger jets. Boeing, so 30, 40 passengers, you're probably in an Embraer. It's a very well-run global aerospace company that happens to be incorporated in Brazil. And the reason I emphasize that, in 2004, 97% of Embraer's revenues came from the U.S. and Western Europe, 3% from Brazil. If I give it a Brazilian country risk premium and I punish it with a very large premium, I think I'm being cruel to an embryo because that's not where its exposure comes from. So you can have an emerging market company like TCS or Infosys or Embraer that actually looks like a developed market. And conversely, you can have companies that you think of as developed market companies that have a significant emerging market exposure. So, you know, if you take Ambev, another Brazilian company, it started off as just a Brazilian brewing company, but over the last 20 years has become a Latin American brewing company. You ask me, what risk premium? The risk premiums I use will reflect where they get revenues. They still get the bulk of their revenues in Brazil, 64%, but they're now getting revenues elsewhere. You're saying, what does it matter where you get your revenues in Latin America? The only people who ask this question are people not from Latin America. Because does it make a difference whether you get your revenues in Chile or Venezuela? Absolutely. So if you get half your revenues from Venezuela, I'd like to know, just don't call it Latin America. Because it's a very different risk profile. And as I said, this is not just emerging market companies. If you take Coca-Cola, you say it's a U.S. company. Yeah, technically it is. Its headquarters is in Atlanta. But it is a multinational that derives a big chunk of its revenues from the rest of the world. This is the breakdown for Coca-Cola. Yeah? So you see the North America is right there. It's about 40%. But 60% of the revenues come from the rest of the world. And I've taken an equity risk premium. And you're saying, how do you come up with the regional premiums? We go back a couple of pages. You'll notice I have regional averages. You know how I compute them? It's a weighted average. Why? Because if I take Asia and I have China and the Philippines, it's silly to weight them both equally. I weight them based on GDP. So that way, if you tell me your revenues come from Asia, I'm going to give you the weighted average, not some simple average or take the safest country, because that would make no sense. So the weighted average for Coca-Cola reflects where it gets revenues. Question?
Doesn't the currency problem, like how do you deal with the currency?
I can pick any currency I want. I can value Coca-Cola in dollars. I can value it in pesos. I can value. So when I do the risk premium, I still get a choice of the risk-free rate. This is the risk premium part. So if your question is, aren't these dollar risk premiums? Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah, because you made a point of not mixing rates.
Yeah. So let me rephrase your question. You're saying these risk premiums are probably dollar risk premiums, and they are, because they come from dollar spreads. If I, let's say, decide to do a Brazilian company in reais, should these risk premiums have to be adjusted for the fact that my risk-free rate is now a real risk-free rate? I'll give you the lazy answer and the not-so-lazy. If your risk-free rate is pretty close to mine, so if I'm doing things in euros or I'm doing things, I'm going to take these risk premiums because the spreads are going to carry. But if your risk-free rate is 8, 10, 12%, I am probably understating your cost of equity using these dollar premiums. We'll talk about an adjustment you can make to do that. But it's true. And the reason we're stuck with dollar spreads is most of these securities trade as dollar securities. It's not because I'm being parochial and picking dollars. That's where the data is. Question? Yeah, and that's actually one of the problems. What am I using to weight your risk premiums? Revenues. You're saying, doesn't it matter that all my aircraft are made in Brazil? What am I missing? The entire production side of the equation. I'll tell you when this becomes the dominant worry. Let's say that you're valuing an oil company, Royal Dutch. You know that oil companies sell their oil into a global market. They really don't even sell to countries. But where does the risk in Royal Dutch come from? It doesn't come from where their revenues come from. It comes from where they get their oil. So guess what? When I did my equity risk premium for Royal Dutch, I looked at where they got their oil. So here's my indirect answer to your question. You don't have to use revenues. You could use production. In fact, you don't even have to pick between the two. You can use both, depending on the business you're in. If you're a consumer product company with very low manufacturing costs, I'm going to focus on revenue. So Coca-Cola, I don't care where your factories are. In fact, they've spun off the bottling operations, so I can focus on revenues. If you're an automotive company, then I'm going to have to bring in where your plants are because it's a much bigger part. And if you're a natural resource company, I'm not even going to ask you where your revenues come from. I'm going to go entirely to production. There's no one-size-fits-all. You're trying to make your best judgment. One of the questions you might have, though, is why did I just break Coca-Cola's revenues by region? Why didn't I break it down by country? You got to live in the world you're in, not the world you wished you were in. You're going to see me use that expression over and over again. And you got to take whatever breakdown the company gives as your starting point. And guess what? Companies are incredibly sloppy about breakdown, especially U.S. companies. Here's what a typical U.S. company's revenue breakdown will look like. We get 74% of our revenues in the U.S., 26% from the rest of the world. Come on, guys. The rest of the world is a really big place. Could we start to get more specific? But guess what? If that's all they give me, I'm going to have to take it and run with it. So sometimes you say, I wish companies were better about breaking down geographic exposure, but often you're stuck with what you have. Okay? Yes?
Does where you are listed matter as well?
I don't care. And this is, I think, the Chinese problem, right? You listed in Hong Kong, you listed in Shanghai. Frankly, your pricing could be different. You know why? Liquidity varies. You got all these restrictions on who can trade, war. That's a pricing issue. But if you look at the value of a company, the value of a company shouldn't change just because you list in Shanghai as opposed to Hong Kong. Your pricing could. What? The what? Is Alibaba any safer or riskier just because it has a NASDAQ listing? You tell me. From an intrinsic value standpoint, it is still Alibaba. Baidu is just a search engine that nobody outside China uses. I mean, let's be real, right? I mean, the only reason you use Baidu is you get there, you type, I remember the first time I was in Shanghai, I get there, I look for my blog, it's disappeared. There's no blog. I said, what the hell happened here? Then I said, let me go do Google search. No Google search. $1 trillion in market cap disappeared in the 16 hours I was in flight from San Francisco to Shanghai. And the answer, of course, is I was supposed to use some VPN and go around the back door and said, I'm too lazy. I'm here 2 days. I don't care. But Baidu is listed on the NASDAQ, but it is still a Chinese search engine. It's something I think, and this is why I think companies do it. If companies value you based on where you're listed, you know what's going to happen, right? Every company that's in a risky country is going to try to relist in a safe country, saying, look, I'm safe now. I still remember when the first South African gold mining companies delisted in Johannesburg and relisted in London. I was talking to the CFO of one of these companies. I said, why did you do that? He said, we wanted to make country risk go away. I said, really? That's all you had to do? What's the next step? Are you going to take those mines out of South Africa and put them in the middle of Lancashire, Yorkshire, or right outside London? You can't move risk. Risk comes from where you do business. But we play these games. There could be a pricing effect. Remember we talk about value versus price? There can be a pricing effect. And we can talk about liquidity and pricing effects. But value is value. It comes from the business you're in. And relisting shouldn't change it. So when you think about coming up with this equity risk premium, that is the default approach I use. Once in a while, I might get a little fancy. And here's what I mean. Remember how beta measures exposure to macroeconomic risk? So about 15 years ago, I was on a flight to Brazil, and I was doing a valuation seminar. I was valuing Embraer. And I was doing the conventional way, which is to give it this big Brazilian risk premium. I realized I was punishing Embraer too much because I looked at the pie chart of revenues and said, this is really a global aerospace company that's in Brazil. So I land in Brazil, and I say, wouldn't it be neat if instead of attaching a country risk premium to every Brazilian company, I measured how exposed a Brazilian company was to Brazilian country risk, and I estimated that with a lambda. You're saying, why a lambda? Here's a trick. I've discovered that if you attach a Greek alphabet to whatever you're doing, it adds a layer of sophistication that makes people not question you. So think of lambda like a beta. Just like beta measures the exposure to all of the risk, lambda measures the exposure to country risk. So I throw it out there, and of course one of the more practical people in the audience says, that sounds like a good idea, but how do you plan to estimate lambda? I said, I have a long flight back. Now think about it. In fact, I wrote one of my papers, it's on my website. I actually wrote it entirely on that flight. It's a long flight, nothing to do. It's called Estimating Company Risk Exposure to Country Risk. Essentially, things you can use to estimate lambda. So let's think about it. One of the simplest ways to do it is to focus on revenues. Why revenue? Because that's, again, one of the few things companies are open about reporting. So let's suppose you have two companies, Tata Motors and Tata Consulting Services. In 2008-09, Tata Motors got about 91% of its revenues in India. Tata Consulting Services got about 8% of its revenues in India. The average Indian company in that year got about 80% of its revenues in India. Again, this is very pragmatic. There's no science involved. What I'm doing is I'm taking the 91 and dividing by 80. I get a lambda 1.14 for Tata Motors. Why? Because it gets more revenues in India than the typical Indian company. And I do the same thing for TCS. I get a lambda of 0.09. You know what? 1 year later, if you've done the same calculation for Tata Motors, its lambda dropped to 0.8. What happened in 2010 that made Tata Motors' lambda drop so dramatically? They did an acquisition. You know who they acquired? Jaguar Land Rover. The minute they acquired Jaguar Land Rover, what did they get? Exposure to global markets. So when companies do acquisitions, especially emerging market companies buying developed market companies, your lambdas can be a mechanism for reflecting how your country risk exposure changes. Okay? The problem again with this approach is I'm focused entirely on revenues. So I'm going to close this section with a very fancy way of estimating lambdas that I never use. What am I trying to measure with country risk, with lambda? I'm trying to see how exposed you as a company are to country risk, right? So I want to know how your how this company reacts when country risk changes. So I looked up two numbers. One is the returns on the stock, which we do for a new computer. And then I looked up the returns on a country bond. You see what I'm trying to do? Because when countries have trouble, where does it show up? It shows up in the country bond. The country bond jumps up and down. And I looked to see how the two moved. It's like a beta calculation, but instead of regressing returns on the stock against returns on a market index, I'm regressing returns on a stock against returns on a country bond. The slope of that line is a lambda. So in this case, Embraer is the company you talked about, aerospace company. The slope of the line was 0.27. Its lambda is 0.27. It's 0.27 times as risky as the average Brazilian company when it comes to exposure to country risk. But Embratel, which was then the Brazilian phone company, which got all of its revenues in Brazil and had no way of getting out, had a lambda of 2. It was twice as exposed to country risk. So this I did at the heart of Lula getting elected as president. So basically, you know, you were seeing country risk play out and people freaking out. This is where you will see it, is in those stocks that are more and less exposed to country risk. Now, this is a fight I've been fighting for 30 years, that your lambda should be, your measurement of country risk should be based on where you do operations. And it's been a very difficult fight. In fact, I would say 20% of people now have bought into this. Let's look at it. But 80% of analysts still stick with using where you incorporated. I'll give you that country risk premium. So I'm going to ask you a question. And in fact, before I do that, let me show you what the difference in numbers will be with the two approaches. I took Embraer, and I did 5 different calculations. Don't let the 5 intimidate you. Some I put numbers into the brackets and multiplied by beta. But here's the difference. 3 of those numbers gave me 9 to 11%. And 2 of the numbers gave me 17% plus. And here's what made them different. In the two approaches where I punished Embraer for being a Brazilian company by giving it the entire Brazilian risk premium, I got 17 to 18%. In the 3 approaches where I gave it the benefit of a lower exposure because it has so much of its revenues outside Brazil, I give it a 10, 11% cost of equity. Hold on to the thought. Don't think about the specifics. So if I treat Embraer as just another Brazilian company, I get a 17% cost of equity. If I treat Embraer as a company that gets a lot of its revenues outside Brazil, I get 10 to 11%. And what do we say most analysts do? They use the 17% because Embraer is a Brazilian company. So and this is the page I had to completely rewrite. So if you look at your slides, you're going to freak out and say, what the hell is he asking? I had no idea what I was asking. So I wrote the page again. So I'll send you this page because this is something I want you to think about. Because remember, we said investing is an act of faith. So let's suppose analysts do the conventional thing. They put 17%, 18%, 19% discount rates on all Brazilian companies. So what are they doing? They're pushing down the pricing for these companies. You come along and say, you know what, Embraer gets 97% of its revenues from outside Brazil. I think it's worth a lot more. And then what do? When you act on your valuations, you go buy Embraer. What's your nightmare scenario? They continue to keep doing what they're doing, in which case what happens? You can sit there wagging your fingers saying, this is terrible, but you're not making any money. There is no way to cause convergence. And this is where the faith part of the process comes in. I continue to believe that in the long term, something will happen that will remind these analysts that Embraer is not just another Brazilian company. Because If that something doesn't happen, I could be right and I could go bankrupt being right. And actually, I have a list of companies like Embraer, like Infosys, like TCS. In every country, there's at least one or two companies that get the bulk of their revenues outside. And you know what I do? I wait for a crisis. You think, what if there's no crisis? We're talking an emerging market. There will be a crisis. It's not a question of whether. It'll be a political crisis. And you know what happens in a crisis, right? What happens? People behave like sheep, especially foreign institutional investors. They all flee the country. What do they sell? Everything. They're not discriminating. They sell Embraer, they sell Embratel, they sell all Brazilian companies. I wait for about a week after the crisis, and they say, I've always wanted Embraer. This seems like a good price. And I buy it. And I said, so please, God, let them see the light. And usually it takes a while. It's actually been a segment of my portfolio that has actually been one. So I bought Embraer right after Lula got elected. For those of you who don't know who Lula is, when he was running for election, he was considered like a left-wing version of Bernie Sanders. You think there's something to the left of Bernie Sanders? Yeah, Lula was, you know, a trade union leader. And people sold everything in Brazil. They abandoned Brazil, including Embraer. And I had Embraer on my radar, and I said, you know what? Embraer might be a Brazilian company, but people are going to be buying these small aircraft, whether Lula gets elected or not, doesn't get elected. And it's still in my portfolio. It's one of the three Brazilian stocks that has stayed in my portfolio. And it's done really well simply because, you know, over time people start to say, you know what, it's a Brazilian company. Look, its earnings are not being hurt by what's happening in Brazil. That's what you're hoping for. Their revenues are in US dollars, their earnings are in dollars. They manage to evade the worst of it, and you're hoping at some point in time that recognition will come on. But if you ask me, can you prove that it'll happen? Absolutely not. Okay? So if you get a chance, take five or six emerging markets, especially maybe markets you're familiar with, and start listing out companies like Embraer, which would be companies that are incorporated in the country but get the bulk of their revenues from developed markets. Don't make it just overseas, because you could be getting your revenues from Venezuela, in which case you jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. You want the revenues to be coming from safe markets, and then sit and wait. And if you're patient, the time will come and the price is right. So it's something to think about. This is, again, not an abstraction. This is about finding stocks that trade at a price that you think is less than their intrinsic value. So now let me turn to the other way of thinking about equity risk premiums. So when you think about implied equity risk premiums, here's what I want you to think about. When you pay something for a risky asset, as in the example that you gave me, you're already telling me what your expected return has to be. And when you give me your expected return, I can back out from that what your risk premium should be. That's what an implied equity risk premium is. And in fact, all I do is I take what you pay for stocks, I project out expected cash flows on stocks, which is a little tricky, but you'll see how I do it. Then I compute an internal rate of return given what you paid for stocks. Now, I tell people to think about how you compute yield to maturity on a bond. Do you remember from foundations or for your first? How do you compute the yield to maturity on a bond? You've already forgotten. You take the price of the bond, you take the coupons and the face value. The yield to maturity is that discount rate that makes the present value of those cash flows equal to the price of the bond. It's an IRR for a bond. I'm doing exactly the same thing for stocks. So enough of the abstractions. Let me take you back to January 1st, 2008. It was a long time ago. It was a year before the start of the year where the crisis kicked in. On January 1st, 2008, the S&P 500 was at 1,468.36. So instead of buying a bond, you bought those stocks. The cash flows that you see there come from two sources. When you buy stocks, you don't get coupons, you get dividends. And in the US, increasingly, you're dependent on buybacks because that's the other way cash is returned. And I don't know what those cash flows will be in the future, but at the start of 2008, I took the cash flows from the previous 6 years because I knew what they were, and I applied a growth rate based on what analysts were projecting for stocks collectively. So what you see here are my expected cash flows for the next 5 years. You see what happens after year five? You don't fall off a cliff. These are the 500 largest market cap stocks, where the cash flows will keep going. At what rate? I will assume they will continue to grow at the same rate as the economy. And that puts me in a bad place because I now have to estimate what that rate has to be. So I'm going to cheat. And I'm going to fall back on this cheat over and over again. And I'll come back and justify it. I use my risk-free rate as my proxy for the growth rate. And I talked a little bit about why in the last session. If you think about it, the risk-free rate has an inflation rate and a real growth in there. I put the risk-free rate in. I've got the problem set up, right? I've got the level of the index, 1468.36. There are my cash flows for the next 5 years. There's the cash flow in perpetuity growing at the risk-free rate, which is 4.02% at that point in time. I solve for the discount rate. It's a tricky solve because your last number itself is going to be... So I actually have to use the solver function in Excel. And when I do that, I come up with 8.39%. You're saying, what does that even mean? At the start of 2008, if you bought U.S. stocks, I don't care what you hoped you would make, what you prayed you would make, what you thought you would make, given what you paid for those stocks, you can expect to make 8.39%. You subtract out the risk-free rate of 4.02%, my implied equity risk premium on January 1st, 2008. Was 4.37%. So let's say that we had done this start of 2008, you went out and bought U.S. stocks. Are you feeling pretty okay about the 4.37%? It doesn't look bad. But then, in the middle of the year, you'd have had a problem. Of course, the crisis kicked in. So you go 1 year forward, just 12 months later. Remember what the index was in start of 2008? It was just a page ago. You can turn the page if you want. 1468.36. Started 2009, the index was at 903. That's a pretty bad year. It's a really bad year. It's the worst year since the Great Depression, actually. So the index has dropped. The economy has gone into shock. So the cash flows had also dropped off. The growth rates had also been pummeled because people were worried. If you bring those all in and solve for the implied equity risk and the risk-free rate, so everything's changed, right? Growth is lower, cash flows are lower, the index is lower. I recomputed the implied equity risk premium at the start of 2009. The number I get is 8.64%. Not that much higher than 8.39%. But because the risk-free rate had dropped to 2.21%, my equity risk premium had dropped to increased to 6.43%. Started the year, the equity risk premium was 4.37%. By the end of the year, it was 6.43%. Remember what I said at the start of this discussion? I said, you want a risk premium that's dynamic, that's forward-looking, that reflects the world you live in? That's what I'm trying to do. You're in a crisis. You're worried about whether there'll be a next year in the first place. Guess what? You're going to demand a higher risk premium, and I'm delivering it to you. And I've done this pretty much at the start of every year, going back to the 1990s. I used to do it once a year and use it for the rest of the year. And my defense is, how much can a risk premium change in a year? It's a developed market. And God has a way of waiting for you to ask these questions because he says, you want to see how much they can change? Here, this is the implied equity risk premium by day. Between September 12th of 2008 and December 31st. You think, what's so special about September 12th? It was a Friday. I distinctly remember. I left my office at like 3:30. Why did I leave at 3:30? I come in when I want, I leave whenever I want, and I felt like leaving. So I was on the train. I used to live in New Jersey then. So I was on the train back, and the news was coming. I was looking at the news stories, and there was a news story that Lehman was having some trouble and that they were negotiating to sell themselves to Barclays. You know what my reaction was? That's too bad. I know a lot of people who work at Lehman. But this is not a market-moving story. It's a Lehman-moving story. And how wrong I was, because you woke up on Monday to a nightmare for the ages. Because the crisis started. And day by day, this was what I paid as a penalty. Every day as I was coming into work, I'd compute the equity risk premium as of that day. It's like, how much can change in a day? You had days in that crisis where the Dow would be up 1,000 points by midday and end the day at 1,500 points lower. People were freaking out, and the risk premium reflects it. So day by day, see this green line? That's my implied equity risk premium by day. I started at 4.37%, close to where I was at the start of the year. There was a day in November where the equity risk premium in the U.S. was higher than 8%. Talk to people who were in the market during those 4 months. It was the most terrifying period to ever be in markets because everything you thought you could go to in a period of safety was gone. Because if you're in an emerging market, this happens. You expect it. You move to a developed market. You take your money out of Sao Paulo. You put it in Miami. But this was happening across the world. There was no place to go. You know what this told me? Never again would I compute the equity risk premium once at the start of the year and use it for the rest of the year. So starting in 2008, I've been computing the implied equity risk premium at the start of every month. And you can be the beneficiary. You go to my website. And I do this like clockwork, start of every month. And that number is what you will see. So at the start of this year, as was my practice, January 1st, I compute the implied equity risk premium. So I'm doing the same thing I did at the start of 2008 and 2009 at the start of 2020. The index was at 3,230.78. The cash flows, if you look at how much of my cash flows come from buybacks, that gives you the breakdown. 60% plus of the cash flows in U.S. stocks came from buybacks last year. The growth rate I'm using is the growth rate for the future that analysts who track the S&P are estimating, and it's not a big number. The growth rate of the projecting is about 3.96%. And I saw my return. My expected return at the start of 2020 was 7.12%. Do you remember what it was at the start of 2009? It's an unfair question. It's 8.64%. So you're saying, this is terrible. My expected return on stocks has dropped. But take a look at the risk-free rate, 1.92%. The implied equity risk premium at the start of this year was 5.2%. Every company I valued in January of 2020, take a look at what I used as my equity risk premium for a mature market. It's 5.2%. What am I planning to use in February? I read it in February. I think it's 5.24% and slightly higher. What will I use in March? I have no idea. I'll have to wait till March comes around. This is my way of kind of putting my valuations back on a market-neutral keel, because my job is to not tell you whether the market is cheap or expensive. We'll come back and say, if you ask me that question, I will address it. But if you ask me to value an individual company, I've got to be market-neutral, and this is my risk premium that I would feed through. But this is also a number that I use all the time when people push back on, isn't the market overvalued? Isn't there a bubble? You've heard that, no? You know what drives a lot of that argument, right? Why do so many people feel the market is in a bubble? It's actually very simple. We've had 10 good years. The market is up 250% over the last decade. And when markets have been going up for a long time, people start to get uncomfortable. It's human nature. So the lazy answer to why so many people think it's a bubble is, we've had 10 good years, there must be a bad year waiting around the corner. So, and then they bring out things like, look at the Shiller P, look at this, look at that. It's all a bunch of kabuki, basically, because it really means absolutely nothing, because you're picking a piece of the puzzle. You know, one way to ask the question, are stocks in a bubble, or is look at this equity risk premium. 5.2%. You're saying, what does that tell me? If you think that number is too low, given what you think the risk in the world is, then you think stocks are overpriced. There should be a correction, right? Because a higher premium will push down. If you think that number is too high relative to what you think it should be, then you think stocks should go up. You're saying, how the hell do I know what's high or low? Well, let me help you out. I've computed the implied equity risk premium for the U.S. going back to 1960. In this graph. So I've actually put myself in a time machine, effectively, and gone back to start. So I've used no hindsight, because that wouldn't be fair. This graph kind of gives me the implied equity risk premium of the U.S. going back all the way to 1960. And this gives you the history of U.S. equities since 1960. There are the 1960s, incredibly stable period for U.S. stocks. Look at how tight that bound is. Then you go to the 1970s, something is breaking loose, right? The implied equity. What's causing that? Remember, when equity risk premiums go up, what's happening to stock prices? They're going down. When interest rates go up, bond price, same thing. That is the 1970s. What's causing stock markets to implode? What's causing the risk premium to climb? Oil prices started the process, but what did oil prices lead to? Inflation. Stagflation is what Venezuela has, right? So let's not use the stag yet. It was double-digit inflation, which the U.S. had never seen. And inflation is deadly. For stocks. Anybody who's lived in an inflationary country knows how much damage inflation can do to investing. Risk premium shot up. 1978, the equity risk premium in the U.S. hit 6.5%. And I still have, I've saved the front page. I think it was Forbes or Business Week at a front page that stocks are dead. Which should tell you, anytime you see this as a headline somewhere, go out and load up on stocks till they're going out of style. Because 1978, if you bought stocks, you got one of the great bull markets of all time. Stocks go from 6.5. Remember, the premium is dropping. Stock prices are rising. In fact, by the end of 99, the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. was down to 2%. In the end of 99, if you told me you thought stocks were in a bubble, I could see why you were saying that, because 2% is way too low, right? Because relative to history, 2%, but you'd have told me some story and kept investing in stocks. But when people talked about bubbles in the late 90s, they were talking off a 2% risk premium. What do we say the risk premium was at the start of 2020? 5.2%. We're now closer to the top than the bottom. In fact, if you look across the last 60 years, the average implied equity risk premium in the U.S. has been about 4.2%. We're actually higher than that. It's all, even with views just the last 10 years, so the premiums have been higher, we're pretty close to that as well. So if you're going to tell me stocks are in a bubble, stop with the lazy argument they're in a bubble because they've gone up a lot. They're in a bubble because the P.E. ratio is high. You better tell me what in my implied equity risk premium is going to implode on me. And I'll give you some suggestions. Why is my implied equity risk premium so high in spite of the fact that my expected return on stocks is lower than it's been historically? What's keeping the risk premium high? One is T-bond. So you've got to tell me a T-bond rate story which will cause interest rates rise. So maybe you believe the Fed conspiracy theory, which is the central banks back out, the risk premium is going to pop. Hey, then maybe you can argue stocks are overvalued. But then where are you going to go? You obviously should be investing in bonds if that's your rationale. You say, maybe I'll go into real estate. I'm going to show you a graph that should terrify you as well. But this becomes my basis. So next time you're on CNBC and you're watching these market gurus, you know, is the market in a bubble? Just step back, look at your implied equity risk premium page, turn off CNBC, move on, go have a drink or something. It's not. You know, there's really nothing productive you're going to get from this discussion because it's often based on these surface numbers where they pick one number and they make that the basis for a very bad argument. Now, one of the questions, of course, that you know, earlier I think was raised, I don't know, the hoodie, what's his name? Is it about, what's your name again? Sorry? What's your name? Yeah.
Pablo.
Pablo raised the question of when risk-free rates rise, shouldn't risk premiums rise? And you can see why, right? If risk-free rates are 70%, a risk premium of 6% doesn't sound like a reasonable number. So in this graph, I decided to look to see whether risk premiums in the U.S. have been a function of what the risk-free rate is. Right? So basically, the blue line is the risk-free rate, and on the red on top. And the answer is, at least in the U.S., there's been very little correlation between the two. In fact, I'm going to give you the entire data set as your weekly challenge this week. And you can try the statistics out. Is there a relationship? I couldn't find any. At least in the U.S., if you told me the risk-free rate, I can't tell you what the risk premium should be. That's why you can get away using these premiums that look roughly the same across time. So I asked a different question. This is a horrifically bad graph. I don't know what possessed me. Right? So I said, let's talk about equity risk. What did I describe the equity risk premium as? It's the price of risk in the equity market, right? Is there a price of risk in the bond market? It's called a default spread. So what I've done in this graph is actually put those two series together. So the green line is my equity risk premium. This black, brown, whatever this line is my default spread on a BAA rated bond. You know why I picked BAA? That's a cutoff for investment grade. So I took an investment grade bond and I took the default spread over time. Let me give you the good news first. Over time, the two tend to move together. When people get scared in one market, they tend to get scared in the other. But there have been two periods in the last 30 years where the two markets have diverged. Take the 1990s. The 1990s, what's happening, the equity risk premium continues to drop. That's a dot-com boom. Okay? But the bond market stays pretty much where it is. In fact, it jumps around. So equity risk premiums are dropping. Bond default spreads stay the same. So if 1998 and 99, here's what you had. The equity risk premium was about 2%. The bond default spread on an investment-grade bond, a pretty safe bond, is about 2%. So if you're an investor, and I said, you can get a bond where you guarantee the coupon, you can make a 2% spread, or you can invest in equities and make the same 2% premium, you're probably, if you were sensible and rational, you're probably going to say, look, I'll buy the bond instead. That was the dot-com divergence. And of course, that blew up after the dot-com bust and the premiums. And then you got to 2003, and you had another divergence. And this was caused by 9/11. After 9/11, Alan Greenspan said, I will not let the U.S. economy go into recession. The key word was I. The hubris of central bankers thinking they can keep recessions away. But here's what central banks did. They pumped up the bond market. They pushed down spreads in the bond market. So if you look at 2002, 2003, 2004, the default spreads are dropping. The equity risk premium is staying up there. People ask me what caused the crisis. Of course, people talk about subprime. They talk about the big short. But the essence of the 2008 crisis is in the bond market, people were not charging a high enough default spread. There's nothing wrong with lending to people with bad credit. If you charge a high enough spread, the spread had become too low. The 2008 market crisis was perhaps the first one in market history that was caused by the bond market. Because it dragged the stock market in, the spreads had become too low. So what happened in 2008? The default spreads jumped. The equity risk premiums jumped. And we all felt the pain of seeing our portfolios kind of implode in front of us. You know, one of the problems in markets is people have tunnel vision. You get hired as an equities person, what do you watch? Equity, equity, equity. You're hired as a bond person, you watch the bond market. You're in the same building, you don't even talk to each other. Things can happen that are diverging, but you don't notice because you're so focused on your market. This is what the first macro hedge funds took advantage of. They said, you guys can play the game, but we're going to step back and look at differences across markets. In fact, I'm going to bring one other market into this game, which was also part of the 2008 crisis, which is the housing market, right? I'm going to compute a risk premium for real estate. You know how I'm going to do this? Anybody ever worked in real estate? If you worked in real estate, there's a number called the cap rate. You know what that is? It's what you demand as a real estate developer as your return on real estate. So cap rate of 8%. And it's a number that you can see across the country. You can see it by region. That cap rate at the start of 2020 was about 6.9%. So if real estate developers are demanding 6.9% and the risk-free rate is 1.92%, you can compute a real estate risk premium, right? So I computed that in this graph. And this is a graph that I think shows you how, when we teach investing, we often stay caught in the past. In this graph, I have three numbers. I have the blue number, that's the equity risk premium. The black is the default spread. And this green line is actually the risk premium on real estate. You're saying, what the heck is going on in the 80s? In the 80s, the risk premium on real estate is actually negative. You are getting less than the risk-free rate. So why would I settle for that? That sounds absurd. When I was start investing, and this was in the late 70s, early 80s, here's what I was told. If you're an investor who's invested primarily in stocks and bonds, you should invest in real estate, finish the rest of the rationale. Why? Because real estate allows you to diversify. It doesn't move like stocks and bonds. And guess what? In the 1980s, it was absolutely true. And when you're buying insurance, a hedge against inflation, guess what? You'll settle for a low expected return. Take a look at what the rest of the graph does here. As you get to the 90s and through, what's starting to happen? Real estate is starting to behave like the financial asset market. What do you think caused this? Essentially, what happened in the 90s is you start to see the securitization of real estate. Mortgage-backed securities were only a piece of the puzzle. You start, and it turns out that when you start securitizing something, it starts to lose its characteristics as a fundamental asset. And this is really bad news for most of us. And here's why. Essentially, you graduate, you start accumulating wealth, you're going to buy stocks and bonds, but for much of your life, what's your biggest asset in your portfolio? The house you buy, right? And historically, that's acted as a hedge against what's happening in your portfolio. In today's world, guess what's going to happen? The year that your stocks and bonds are down 30%, you look at a house, guess what it's going to be down by? Another 30%. Real estate is no longer something that's going to let you diversify. And that's what this graph tells me. So when you look at these risk premiums, you can get some very big perspectives on how markets are changing and how that should change. So let me close with the final page. So basically, if you look at the implied equity risk premium now, it's about 5.2%. But if you go all the way back in time, you know, the historical risk premium is about 8.18%. So this has happened to me in an investment bank, so I'll play out how this plays. I go to an investment bank, I do my implied equity risk premium, let's say it's 5.2%. And the banker says, oh, it doesn't matter. We use a very different number, 8.18%, but everybody in the bank uses 8.18%. At least we're being consistent. Tell me what's going to happen to the value